Today on Annenberg Radio News.
I care about the audience perception because I'm a member of the audience. There's bound to be some other people who are going to get it too.
Composer Stephen Hartke talks about the inspiration behind his symphony, Number 4. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Thursday, November 20th, 2014. I'm Priyanka Deo. In just about an hour, President Obama is expected to make an announcement that will directly impact the lives of millions of immigrant families. The move will have particular importance in California, which is home to almost one-fourth of the undocumented immigrants in the United States. Rebecca Gibeon reports.
Obama is expected to give an executive order that will give temporary work visas and temporary reprieve from deportation to about 5 million people. In California, 22% of illegal immigrants have lived in the United States for at least 20 years. Jaime Hortensia crossed illegally and just received citizenship a year ago. She still has family members who live illegally. She is hopeful for today's announcement.
Because there are many families that have been suffering and that have not been together, and the children are the ones that suffer. It would be the best Christmas gift because...
Teresa Torres immigrated legally in 1985. Torres came to America to better the lives of her family. However, many of her family members are still living in the United States illegally, including her sister.
Well, she has a degree in Mexico. She doesn't speak very well, but she drives. She drives, she has a car, and she's smart, but hopefully she'll get something so she'll get a better job because she's a degree in business administration.
Pierrette Hogdenew-Sotella, the associate director at the Center for the Study of Immigrant Integration, explained that temporary work permits will allow immigrants to raise their economic status and focus on their families without fear of deportation.
Mixed status families always live in fear of being torn apart because of deportation and detention.
For now, immigrant families will just have to hope for the best. Rebecca Gibeon, Annenberg Radio News.
And now Rebecca joins us live from the Metropolitan Detention Center in downtown LA, where some of those families have gathered to watch the president's speech on immigration. Rebecca, what's the scene like?
Hey, Priyanka. The scene's pretty small right now, but it's actually been growing even in just the 15 minutes that I've been here. There are a ton of people making banners, and there's some live music happening.
All right. And what kind of presidential action are people hoping to hear tonight?
They are hoping that Obama will stick to his word about what he said earlier to make temporary legalization for about 5 million immigrants living in the United States.
Okay, and have you seen any protesters there?
There are no protesters. There are a couple people from the California Immigration Youth Justice Alliance, and I spoke to Luis Ojeda, and he's one of the lead members, and he is here. He's a little angry at Obama, but is hoping to let everyone know that they are willing to continue the fight in California to make sure Obama sticks to his word.
All right. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thanks, Priyanka.
South Los Angeles community leaders and local officials gathered today to finalize an application to make the area a promise zone. The designation would help South LA get more funds for anti-poverty programs. Victor Figueroa reports.
South Los Angeles was originally left off the list of promise zones, or areas singled out for investment made by President Obama last year. Community members gathered today at Los Angeles Trade Technical College to add their signatures onto applications to get South LA on that list. Local organizations had to work together to show the administration that they are ready to put grant money to work. LA Trade Tech president and South LA native Leticia Bajaras said being left off the list was a wake-up call.
I think South LA needed a shaking up, a wake-up call saying, if you do unite, you can be successful. And that's really what happened with the whole notion of how did some other zone get a promise zone and not South LA? How can South LA be left out? But we need to make sure we hold ourselves accountable and we have clear metrics that show that this investment that we absolutely need is going to overall pay off in the long run.
If their application is accepted, one thing local officials plan to do is create a low-fare transportation card for college and high school students. Victor Figueroa, Annenberg Radio News.
Tuition at University of California schools is going up, way up. Officials voted today to raise tuition by as much as 5% a year over the next 5 years, unless state officials increase school funding. The increase, which would add more than $3,000 to in-state tuition by 2019, came amid angry student protests and sit-ins at campuses across the state. UC officials say the hikes could be reduced or eliminated if state funding increases, but Governor Jerry Brown has said the state schools need to be more responsible with its spending. A large group of defendants is asking a court today to have their crimes reduced from felonies to misdemeanors. Courts have seen many of these requests since Prop 47 passed earlier this month. Prop 47 allows certain drug and property crimes to be downgraded. Prosecutors and attorneys both say the surge of legal action is stretching the state resources, allowing offenders with serious criminal records to take advantage of the law. Suzanne Kang Schroeder is the chief of staff for the Orange County District Attorney's Office.
We have extremely scary situations where we have guys with multiple strikes who should have been knocked away for life getting probation and misdemeanors.
Attorney Kate Corgan says the DA's office is way off base.
Until we see something like this happen where they all of a sudden have somebody who goes out and commits some act of violence, I don't think they have anything to hang their hats on.
Acclaimed stage and screen director Mike Nichols, whose career spanned almost six decades, has died today at the age of 83. Andy Vasoyan has this look back.
Here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Mike Nichols may be best known for his work on the 1967 classic The Graduate, but the multi-talented director's efforts have been featured on Broadway, the silver screen, and television. The German-born director is one of only 12 people in history to have won an EGOT, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Award. Nichols said in a 2005 interview with Charlie Rose that the heart of all his productions were similar.
There's only one question. Whatever, whether you're doing Angels in America or Spamalot, or Hell's a Poppin' or Macbeth, the question is, what is this really like in life?
Nichols won a Tony Award, one of seven for Best Directing, for Monty Python's Spamalot, a fan-favorite musical comedy about the Knights of King Arthur.
I want to be a knight, but I don't like to fight. I'm rather scared I may simply run away.
Nichols said in a 1986 interview with the Washington Post that his subjects were always the relationships between men and women. Nichols' unique way of bringing relationships to life will be heard on screen, on stage, and every time somebody mentions a Mrs. Robinson. Andy Vasoyan, Annenberg Radio News.
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know.
And Thanksgiving is just a week away. Today we saw temperatures approaching 70 degrees. Tonight we'll sink into the low 50s with a chance of rain for tomorrow's Conquest concert on McCarthy Quad. It should be mostly sunny for Saturday's football game against UCLA at the Rose Bowl. Later on Annenberg Radio News, how college athletes hoping to go pro insure themselves against career-ending injuries. Composer Stephen Hartke is one of the most distinctive voices in contemporary classical music. Tonight, the Los Angeles Philharmonic will premiere his fourth symphony. Hartke spoke with Elizabeth Nonnemaker about the piece and what it's like to write for the orchestra.
Composing for the orchestra is such a huge undertaking. How did you start the piece?
Well, it's always a process of discovery, and I believe that every piece is about the potential interaction of the forces that you've chosen for the piece. So here I had an enormous orchestra plus an incredibly colorful and versatile instrument in the organ. And the first thing I really had to do was to figure out how I would limit what I was going to use. That meant I had to work with the organ itself, and the folks at the Philharmonic made it possible for me to go in on off times, sometimes very late at night, to work on the organ. So I was the Phantom of Disney Hall at 1 o'clock in the morning playing strange sounds. So I would play and record myself playing things, take notes about what the combinations of colors were I was using, and then I just sort of decided at a certain point, let's say, this is what I'm going to use. I will say that I had an idea of the thrust of the piece from the get-go. It involves a very roiling, dark opening of chords that rise from the depths, and then there's a very high, piercing melody that's played by the organ in a kind of voice and color that only the organ has.
How has it been working with the Phil, and how do you give good feedback to a group that has a limited amount of rehearsal time?
When you're dealing with any kind of orchestra piece, it's always tough because you never get as much rehearsal as you really should have. Orchestras would admit that, but there's just limitations of budget. So you have to listen for those things that you actually have the power to change between that moment and then the next time that people get together. I can go home and I can make a list of things that I can present to Gustavo Dudamel, and I have to make sure that that list is succinct, well organized, and maybe arranged in an order from the most easily achievable to, if we can't do this, that's okay. But the main issue has to do with balance. And that's always going to be an issue with a new piece. So just making sure that the foreground, middle ground, background distinctions are as close to what it is that I imagined as possible.
Do you think about the way you want the audience to perceive your music?
Well, this is a question that comes up all the time, and it's one I've always answered by saying that I care about the audience perception, and I care about them because I'm a member of the audience. And I figure that if I am able to write something that seems powerful or clear enough or persuasive emotionally to me, that there are bound to be some other people who are going to get it too.
Hartke's Fourth Symphony runs through Saturday at Disney Concert Hall and has a concluding performance at the Segerstrom Concert Hall in Orange County on Sunday. A water conservation group has challenged LA residents to stop washing their cars. LA Waterkeeper even got the city of Santa Monica to go dirty for the drought. But as Taylor Haney reports, the campaign's growing popularity is making some car wash owners cringe.
I went to Red Carpet Car Wash to find out how owners are responding to anti-cleaning pledges. A fan blew all that water into a floor grate to be recycled for the next wash. The state of California requires it.
80% of the water is recycled.
That's Roger Patterson, the car wash manager.
20% we use clean, and we also help the drought by having a recycling pump to recycle the water.
He said business has gone down by 10 to 15% since the drought started. And he said a professional car wash is the best way to save money and water.
Long before being green was a thing, car washes were doing it. It's just a matter of good business.
Gary Pendleton agrees. He owns several California car washes, and he helms Pro Wash, a car wash consulting firm. He's not fond of the dirty car pledge.
I think it's pretty ridiculous.
Ridiculous because letting your car go dirty might harm it in the long run.
By taking the pledge and allowing everything to just sit on your car for an extended period of time, you're doing an immense amount of damage.
Rachel Stitch from L.A. Waterkeeper says the organization means no offense to car cleaners.
We're in no way against the car wash industry or trying to put them out of business or anything like that.
She says the car wash is just the catalyst to prompt residents to think about their water use. Santa Monica says it will wash its big blue buses only every other day, saving 70,000 gallons in 2 months. Andrew Buzmagian from the city's sustainability office says residents shouldn't worry about riding dirty buses.
The buses are not going dirty in the clearest sense of the word. They're being less than sparkling.
With the cities of Burbank and Malibu joining in next, the Dirty Car Pledge is just getting rolling. Taylor Haney, Annenberg Radio News.
Being gay or transgender behind bars can come with safety risks that average inmates doesn't face. The LA Men's Central Jail provides a safe place away from the general population. I sat down with USC Annenberg student Ani Yukar, who wrote about the wing for LA Weekly. So can you tell us a little bit about the experience?
Yeah, so my editor and I, we both called 21 of the largest cities jails across the country, and none of them had anything remotely close to what was going on here in Los Angeles. Actually, a lot of them, when I told them about some of the things that was going on down here, they actually laughed and couldn't believe it. So, definitely seems to be the only one of its kind in the country.
Okay, and now tell me a little bit about your article. So you went into this gay wing, and what was your experience like?
Wow. Well, going in, I had no idea what to expect. Last year, I had done a story in a different part of the jail, and, you know, it was definitely colder, not as warm of a feeling. But going into this part of the jail, I actually was greeted with a lot of warmth. A lot of the inmates were very friendly, very nice. I remember one of the first comments I heard going in was, "Oh my God, I love her shoes." And I was shocked by that. And as soon as I heard that, my guard kind of came down, and I was able to talk with everyone pretty comfortably.
When you went into this dorm, you in your article, you talked about Yaya. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yaya, her real name is Dave Williams, but apparently on this side of the jail, nobody likes to be called by their real names. They take it offensively. She prefers to go by Yaya, and she was a fabulous character. I learned a lot from her about the culture inside of there. She's actually the house mouth of this particular dorm.
What is that?
A house mouth is the person it's not technically condoned by the deputies, but according to the inmates, it's the house mouth is the liaison between the deputies and the inmates, basically like the house representative, if you will. And they nickname call them the house mouse, kind of like a joke about calling someone a rat for, you know, squealing on you or whatever. But in this side of the jail, they're seen as fairies, as one of the inmates called it. They love their house mouth. It really determines the quality of life they have inside the jail is really dependent on who their house mouth is.
The inmates that are in this dorm, they reoffend just to get back in. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so, you know, it is the gay wing of the jail. So a lot of them form relationships with each other. Some of them get married. You know, wedding ceremonies is a thing on this side of the jail. So when one partner gets released, sometimes they will reoffend just so they can be reunited with their loved one that's still behind bars.
Do you have any last thoughts for us?
No, I just hope this, you know, makes some sort of an impact on the way we look at incarceration. And I hope it makes people rethink about this population of inmates that exists that we don't see every day, but they exist. There's 20,000 of them in Los Angeles alone.
And now we check in with Alejandra Rubalcava to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision. Alejandra?
One man will spend the next 4 years breaking global world records. How he's planning to do it. Snowstorms are slamming the East Coast with feet of snow. We spoke with one woman who's stuck in the thick of it. A traveling medical clinic is bringing services to people in LA who need it most. The story of one man they're helping coming up. This story and more at 6 p.m. on ATVN.
Thanks, Alejandra. College football players hoping to be a top pick in the NFL draft face an uncertain few years while they're still in school. An illness or injury could derail a high-paying career playing pro football. Matt Levin talks to us about a little-known type of insurance that could buy some peace of mind.
2 years ago, if you asked Pac-12 defenses for the scariest name in all of college football, the leading response would probably be this guy.
Pick up. Lee comes in motion a little bit. Barkley drops the pass. Lee in a slant and catches the ball at the 35. Stays on his feet to the 30. Down the middle to the 20. He's at the 10. He's in the end zone. Touchdown, USC.
That's former USC wide receiver Marquise Lee. And in 2012, he was an absolute nightmare for opposing defenses.
USC, 80 yards. They just couldn't catch up to him.
Most NFL insiders were projecting Lee as at least a top 10 draft pick. For Lee, that meant a $12 million payday was only a year away. A lot can happen in a year.
Marquise is slow to get up.
He is writhing back and forth.
After suffering a knee injury during a punt return in his junior season, Lee's production tanked. So much so that when the draft finally did roll around, Lee wasn't selected until the early second round. He ultimately signed a $5 million deal with the Jacksonville Jaguars, which doesn't sound too bad, but remember, Lee was originally projected to make at least $12 million before his injury. All that money would be lost for Lee if it wasn't for three words.
Loss of value.
Loss of value.
Loss of value insurance.
Before his junior year, Lee bought what's called a loss of value insurance policy. While they are popular in baseball and basketball, they are most common in college football.
You look at the average contracts that they'll sign coming out, you want to protect a certain portion of that. Again, in the event that a player suffers a catastrophic injury.
That's Chris Larshevik, Executive Vice President of Sports and Entertainment for International Specialty Insurance. He was the guy who actually wrote the policy Marquise Lee purchased in 2013. The key to loss of value is that a player's fall in draft stock has to be the result of an injury. The player has to prove that it wasn't just a bad year. And Noel Paul, attorney for the law firm Reed Smith, says proving that isn't so simple.
The insurance company could very well argue that. We think it's because NFL teams figured out that, you know what, you're really not that big. You're not the prototype NFL receiver that everyone's looking for.
That's why, for many, the jury is still out on loss of value policies.
Has a player ever collected on a loss of value insurance policy before?
Again, I'm not in everybody's books, but to my knowledge, the answer is no.
Ronnie Kaymore, the CEO of the company that sold Marquise Lee his loss of value policy, said he personally knows of a major conference quarterback that collected on a policy after falling in the draft. But confidentiality agreements do not permit the insurance company to make it public. Even if there is a record of a player collecting on loss of value, the USC Athletic Department doesn't know about it.
Now, whether anybody knows what it really takes to get the loss of value payout, you know, nothing's ever been paid out. You know, I think we had a couple students in the past year, couple years that if those don't pay out, I don't know what will.
Kevin Sargent is the head of athletic compliance at USC. He fields calls regularly from loss of value brokers and makes sure players understand the policies and receive competitive quotes. If Lee gets less than what he thought he would get, it may mean players are less likely to purchase these policies, which means you may see less top players returning to college when they could go pro.
I don't know. I think it would impact it for sure. I don't think it would devastate the business. It could maybe take a year or two to come back from.
No matter the Lee resolution, there are other forces that are pushing athletic departments to promote loss of value policies. Last year, the NCAA ruled that schools can pay for these policies on behalf of athletes. That means schools have an even stronger incentive to promote these policies just to retain a competitive recruiting edge. For Annenberg Radio News, this is Matt Heller.
And now it's time for our weekly Sports Minute with Evan Budrovich. The USC Trojans are preparing for the biggest game of the season against the UCLA Bruins.
The race for first place is up for grabs between two teams ranked inside the top 25. USC has lost both of their last two matchups against UCLA, but that has not derailed sophomore Sua Cravens heading into this must-win game.
Things don't go how they're supposed to unravel. Anything can happen. We can take this game to triple overtime, or it can be a 50-0 win like it was, what, 3-4 years ago. So you never know what happens. You just got to play a game.
UCLA comes in red hot, winning each of its past four games. The Trojans are looking to upset the number 9 ranked Bruins by welcoming back senior J.R. Tavai and Josh Shaw, who was suspended for the first 10 games of the year for lying about saving his drowning nephew from a second-story balcony.
We've been dealing with so much that it's a real character trait of our guys that they have the unique ability to minimize the distractions, focus on the task at hand, and do their job.
The added depth will play a factor, but the biggest question is whether USC can finish in the fourth quarter to keep their slim Pac-12 hopes alive this Saturday at the Rose Bowl. Evan Budrovich, Annenberg Radio News.
Grammy Award-winning rapper Big Boi of Outkast fame will be on campus tonight, not tomorrow, as we previously said, for USC's annual Conquest Concert. A huge bonfire will burn a giant stuffed UCLA bear, and there will be a Ferris wheel and other carnival games. Conquest begins at 7 p.m. on USC's McCarthy Quad. And that's it for this Thursday. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Priyanka Deo.